And I want to talk a little bit tonight about missionary care, because the church in Philippi is exemplary in this area. I want to show that tonight and challenge us and encourage us about this particular matter. One of the most famous missionaries in the history of missions is William Carey, and he went from England to India back in the 18th century. He was a shoe cobbler, but he had a brilliant mind and ended up translating the scriptures into something like 30 languages and dialects. And when he left for the field, he charged his supporters, he charged his denominational leaders and said, "I am going down a deep, dark pit, and I'm going down by a rope. And you all are here at the top holding on to that rope." And he pled with his supporters to be good stewards of that end of the rope. He was going down to these heathen countries, reaching these people for Christ. But he was heavily dependent on people at the top holding on to that rope. And that's called mission care. Mission care is holding on to that rope. And I want to challenge you tonight with that, with the example of the church in Philippi. You probably know the story about how Paul came to Philippi and how he was put in prison and his feet were put in stocks, and the earthquake came, opened all the prison doors, and the guard almost took his own life, but Paul stopped him, and that man got saved that night. His life was on the eternal brink, and Paul was able to urge this man to come to Christ, really not through words, but through his example. And that man came to Christ. And before that, Paul had gone to the river because he had heard that there was a prayer meeting that would take place. There were some women there, and one of those ladies that came regularly to that prayer meeting was Lydia. And we read in the Bible that, in the book of Acts, that God opened her heart. And what a wonderful reminder that we need that exact same thing in missions to happen. I mean, we can send our most gifted missionaries. We can give the people, you know, the best translation of the Bible. We can send all the money to fund those projects. But if God doesn't open the hearts, nothing happens of any eternal value. But God opened the heart of this woman. She was a very wealthy woman, probably. She was a seller of purple textiles that is made with small little animals that you catch in the Mediterranean Sea. They have a sort of dye in their bodies that these people would use to dye fabrics, a beautiful purple. And it was sold at top dollar, or whatever the currency was in those days. And Lydia invites, rather urges Paul to come into her house. She is the first one to provide mission care through hospitality. And later, as Paul is put in prison and later released, we see this guard washing Paul's stripes and putting a meal in front of him. He is another great example of someone who cares for missions by taking care of the missionary. But their ministry for missionaries does not stop at that point. Paul leaves town, but he goes on to the next town, Thessalonica. And we read in Philippians chapter 4, verse 15, that in the beginning of the gospel, says Paul, when I departed from Macedonia, that's the larger area in which Philippi is the main city, no church communicated with me as concerning giving and receiving, but ye only. For even in Thessalonica, he sent once and again unto my necessity. So even after Paul leaves town, they're still sending gifts. They're still sending funds so that Paul is released to minister full time. And not just once, but twice. We read later, if you'll keep your finger here and go back to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, as Paul moves on to Corinth, Paul mentions in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, in verse 9, when I was present with you and wanted, in other words, I had need, I was chargeable to no man, for that which was lacking to me, the brethren which came from Macedonia supplied. So we see a pattern forming here that every time Paul continues to the next town, every time the distance between him and Philippi increases, it doesn't stop these Philippians from traveling behind him and continuing to bring gifts to support his ministry. It's amazing. And it's not just that they have this love affair with Paul only, because later Paul is going to send letters to the Gentile churches throughout the whole Roman Empire, urging them to collect some funds and to send those toward Jerusalem, because there was a great famine in Jerusalem, and the church in Jerusalem was suffering, was having a hard time. And Paul, who was very conscious of the fact that there is this tendency within the first century church to have this rift between Gentile and Jewish believers. There was always tension between those two groups of people. And Paul wants these Jewish Christians to know that these Gentiles are behind them, that they are supporting them. And so he wants this collection made among the Gentile churches for relief in Jerusalem. He says in chapter 8, if we can just continue, just going back to 2 Corinthians chapter 8, he starts that chapter saying, "Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit," or in other words, we want you to know of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of, and here we go again, Macedonia. "How that in great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality." Paul is saying the churches in Macedonia were in great affliction. They were going through trials. Now, what is our tendency when we go through trials? Our tendency is to zoom out everything that's not relevant to our lives and to focus on our problem, right? And what is this church doing in the middle of affliction and trial? Their focus is on those brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. So in the midst of affliction, they're taking up offerings for these dear saints that they've never met, that live hundreds of miles away, that they never will meet until they reach eternity. And it's not just that they were in great affliction, it says they were also in deep poverty. It's like the widow's last night. And Jesus notices, you know the story about this lady who comes to the temple, and she has two coins with her, and it's her last, literally her last coins on earth. It's all she has. And what does she do with it? She puts it in that temple offering that is run by a bunch of hypocrites. But she does this for God. And Jesus sees it. He notices it. He notices when we make real sacrifices. And he cares. And he remembers. And he will supply all your needs, even when you have given your last mite. And this is exactly what this church in Philippi did. Out of deep poverty and great affliction, what are they doing? They're sending money to people that they've never met. It's not just their missionary Paul. It's a church that has needs somewhere out there on the other end of the world. And Paul says, that is the grace of God, verse 1. That is a work of God when a church can function like that, when it can give like that. And that's not even the last time that these people are giving. Go back to Philippians chapter 4, because the whole book of Philippians is a thank you note for another gift that this church has sent. Paul is now in prison. He has a soldier chained to his left and a soldier chained to his right. And he's in prison in a Roman prison cell. He can't go anywhere. And it's not like the prison system in this country where you're going to have your meals every day, you know, you're going to have your time to be outside, and you're going to have access to all sorts of really things inside that prison. You have rights. Well, Paul had no rights. He had no provisions. It's not like some guard would bring a meal by three times a day. Like, you got nothing. You were just chained, and hopefully someone was kind enough from outside the prison to bring you something to eat that day. Or if you had some money, you could order your meal to your prison cell. So Paul needs money even to stay in prison. It's not free to be in prison. And these people send money through Epaphroditus, a member of the church of Philippi. So we see this wonderful pattern emerge from this church. And it is their mission care that really excels, that is really noteworthy, exemplary for us. And Paul responds to this kind of giving with joy. I want you to notice verse 10, where Paul says, "I rejoice in the Lord greatly." Now you expect him to say, "I rejoice in the Lord greatly because my needs are met, and I really had needs in my life." But that is not the reason why Paul rejoices, because not only is the Philippian church exemplary in the way they care for missions, Paul is exemplary as a missionary in the attitude that he displays when he received a gift. "I rejoice in the Lord," verse 10, "greatly, that now at the last, your care of me hath flourished again. In other words, you have been able to send another gift. Wherein you were also careful, but you lacked opportunity. It wasn't that just now they finally got around to wanting to send something. It is that they lacked opportunity. But here, this window of opportunity opened up for them. You couldn't just wire the money. You had to send it physically with someone that you trusted. Wasn't going to run away with it. And the travel itself was dangerous. And it took time. And so now here's this opportunity, and Epaphroditus is able to take a purse to Paul, and they jump at the opportunity. But Paul is not rejoicing in the need that is met. He says that in verse 11, not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am, even in the state of Georgia, therewith to be content. Paul had learned the secret of Christian contentment. He had learned, verse 12, how to be abased. And boy, were there moments in his life that he was abased, brought low, like humiliated by Roman soldiers, humiliated by imprisonment. I mean, how would you like to have on your record that you spent time in prison? He was abased in all sorts of ways. He was lied against, and he was content with that. I am content, says Paul, to be abased. But I also know how to abound. There were times of abounding. There were times when he was received as a hero, that he was taken care of, that he was shown the love and the respect that he deserved. Everywhere and in all things, I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry. And there were times that he went to bed not having eaten the meal. I don't know if you've ever done that in your life before or had to do in your life before. Probably not. We're so full in all sorts of ways, aren't we, in this country? We don't know what it is to have hunger, to go to bed with an empty stomach. Paul did. But he had been instructed. That's a wonderful word in verse 12. It means to be initiated into a secret. It's like when you were a kid and your best friend, you know, came over and you went outside to the treehouse and made sure that no one was around. And then you had this secret meeting, and you were going to have this secret agreement between you and your best friend. You know, there was this initiation into this secret. And, you know, you make promises that you're not going to ever tell anyone, cross your heart, hope to die, etc. And this is the idea. It's like God takes the Apostle Paul aside and says, Paul, I'm going to teach you the secret of contentment, so that if you go to bed hungry or full, it makes no difference to you, because you're content, resting in the provision that I give. That is what Paul learned. And I want to ask you the question, in this country, this wealthy country of yours, have you learned contentment? Because all around us, and it's always culture shock for us to come back to the U.S., I mean, you're just bombarded with advertising. You can't even put gas in your tank, and something out of that filling station is blaring at you in terms of advertising. It's everywhere, and the whole message that you are bombarded with is that material things bring happiness. And we need that bigger car, and we need that bigger house, and we need early retirement, and there's this whole list of the ideal American life. And we're all protected with insurances upon insurances, and our whole lives are just one adventure of pleasure and getting all that there is out of life. Now, I want to ask you the question again. Have you learned in this culture the secret of Christian contentment? Or are you tied to your stuff? Paul certainly wasn't. And the reason he can be both full and empty, abounding and suffering need, is verse 13. He can do all things through Christ. Now again, in our culture here in the West, this is the kind of stuff that athletes say, you know, when they're trying to aim for the top, for championships and, you know, being the best of the best. And they put on their sneakers, Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ. That's not what this verse is talking about. This verse is talking about, I can live the life that Paul lived through Christ. It's not about how high you can reach, it's how low can you stay, and how long can you stay low in circumstances that press in on you. Now, Paul is not rejoicing because his needs are met. He is a far more selfless person than that. He says in verse 17, I don't desire a gift. I'm not happy because I can eat. I desire fruit that may abound to your account. He's saying, I'm happy, I'm joyful, I'm jumping up and down in my prison cell. I'm rattling my chains in joyfulness because I see fruit in your life. Just like 2 Corinthians 8 told us, it is a work of God's grace to make someone a giver, a sacrificial giver in a world in which everyone is hoarding and accumulating. Jesus Christ was a giver. God is a giver. He gave his only son. You heard that verse in Dutch tonight. And when we are transformed into giving people, sacrificially giving people, it is fruit. It is spiritual fruit. It is God's Holy Spirit that works into our hearts, that kind of giving. And it abounds to your account, Paul says. We all have two accounts. We have an earthly account in which all your earthly accumulated wealth is hopefully not getting eaten up by inflation nowadays. But you also have a heavenly account, an eternal spiritual account. And everything that's in your earthly account is going to get eaten up by moths. It's going to get stolen by thieves. It's going to rust and be gone. But everything that you accumulate up there is eternal. And the key to living life down here is to trade everything that you've got down here into currency for up there. This morning we were in a different church and the offering plate came by and I reached into my wallet to see if I could put something in the offering, and the only thing I could find was euros. I thought, well, I don't know if they really want euros in the plate. But it's like, this is worth something in Europe. I can't do a whole lot with it over here, because if I try to give the cashier these bills, she's not going to want those. And I think so often we as Christians, we're so focused on the wrong currency. Yeah, that currency you can do a lot with here on earth, but you try to take it up there and it's worth nothing. They won't take it up there, I can guarantee you. It's worthless. And you've missed your chance. You need to go to that exchange booth and you need to get those earthly treasures exchanged into a heavenly currency. And you need to start laying up treasures in heaven. How do you do that? By investing in the work of God. By giving toward eternal spiritual things. And the Philippians had gotten a hold of this. And Paul understands this. And it just thrills his heart to the core. And so Paul doesn't care if his needs are met. He is focused on these people and on their spiritual growth and their maturity in Christ. And he's seeing these guys are exchanging their worldly goods in for heavenly treasure. And it does him good. There's one other thing that I want to point out. God's view of giving. Now, you can go to multiple places in the New Testament and give perspectives on that. But in verse 18, Paul calls the giving of the Philippian church an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. Did you know that such a simple thing as putting something in the offering plate is actually a sacrifice? Not in the sense that it's costing you something, although that's also the case, but it is a sacrifice in the sense of an Old Testament sacrifice. You are bringing something to God. You are laying it on the altar, and the smoke of that thing is just rising up to the very throne room of God, and it enters his nostrils, if we can speak of God having nostrils, and it is just an irresistible, sweet odor to him. It just makes him happy. He enjoys that kind of giving. It is a beautiful thing when we as Christians can put our wallets on the altar and for the odors of that action to rise up into the very presence of God and for him to be filled with that. Just like when you walk outside in the summertime with flowering plants all over and just the power of the smell that just enters your nostrils. You know, we talk about heaven as a very visually stimulating place, but I think heaven is going to also have smells to it. And certainly, this is not a literal smell here, but to God it is pleasing. It is a sweet odor to him, acceptable. And based on that kind of mission care that this church is displaying, Paul can assure his readers in verse 19, "My God shall supply all your needs according to his riches in glory by Christ Jesus." As soon as we start giving sacrificially, there's some little voice in the back of our minds that starts protesting and thinking, "But how about my needs? Who's going to take care of my needs?" Well, Paul says it right here. You focus on eternal things around you, and God will make sure that your cruse of oil will always flow.